From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with David Attenborough, creator and host of the public television series Life on Earth and The Living Planet. His new series, The First Eden, looks at the natural history of the Mediterranean. Also today, we have a remembrance of bandleader Woody Herman, who died Thursday at the age of 74. In a 1986 interview, Herman looks back on his life in jazz. Brazilian guitarist Orlando Haddad joins us for our weekly performance spot to play an original composition inspired by his father's writing. And critic-at-large Laurie Stone reviews comic Mort Saul's one-man Broadway show. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is David Attenborough. He's taken film crews around the world for his television series Life on Earth and The Living Planet. His documentaries explore natural history, evolution, and animal life. They were produced for the BBC and later broadcast in the United States on public television. His new series, The First Eden, starts Monday on many public television stations. The First Eden was filmed in the area of the Mediterranean, which has been called the Cradle of Civilization. The series explores the natural history of the region and humanity's changing relationship with the natural world. Attenborough has written a companion book, also called The First Eden, which is published by Little Brown. Attenborough was knighted by the Queen of England, as was his brother Richard, who directed the film Gandhi. I spoke with David Attenborough earlier today from the NPR Bureau in New York. Before we got to some of his adventures in the field, he told me why he focused his new series on the Mediterranean.
Well, I've done a number of animal series looking at the natural history of the world, as it were, globally. And in them, programs like Life on Earth and The Living Planet, human beings have appeared, it's true, but they've usually been either, say, Indians in the Brazilian jungle or Aborigines in the deserts of Australia. People who lived by hunting and gathering, but essentially in total harmony with the world, just as much as any other predator would be in harmony with the world. That's one kind of person. Another kind of human being that have appeared in the shows I've done has been people like you and me, that is to say members of highly industrialized societies, and they're usually represented as being wreckers, you know, ecological wreckers, ruining the environment. And, of course, the process of getting from the first to the second is a very crucial process, and the place where it actually first happened is the Mediterranean. And so I thought that would be, well, it's the oldest humanized landscape in the world. It's a place where the evidence of what has happened during that process is most easily and readily and amazingly visible. So I thought I'd do a series there.
Is there a period of history that you see as a turning point where humans became, instead of worshipful of nature or just, you know, involved with nature, they began to exploit nature and to exploit animals?
Yes, and of course we have always exploited animals and plants to some degree, in as much as we can't exist without them. We eat them. We eat either plants directly or at second hand, as it were, through animals that eat plants. And that was always so. But when we first started to exploit nature in a more extravagant way was when we learned how to tame animals and domesticate and sow seeds and reap crops. And that happened around 10,000 years ago, around the eastern end of the Mediterranean.
I've seen the preview reel for the upcoming programs, and one of the scenes, one of the shots, takes place in a cave in Cyprus, and you have footage of fruit-eating bats who live in this cave, and it really made me think about when you're doing a program like this, how do you enter a cave for the first time to make sure that there's nothing terribly dangerous and unexpected lurking in there?
Oh, you hope there is something unexpected lurking there. That'd be even better. The trouble is that sometimes you enter the cave hoping it's... and there's nothing there at all. That's the bit you want to worry about. That's not very difficult, really. I mean, the unexpected is not... is something to be treasured. And indeed, wandering around a jungle or wherever, you hope that you'll find interesting things. The sadness is when there's nothing.
Did you ever get into a cave when you were shocked by what you found?
Not on this trip. I have been in caves elsewhere where I've been fairly shocked by what I found. I remember going into a cave in Borneo a few years ago, and this was a long and very big, hugely tall, like, what was it? It was about 300 feet tall. The ceiling was 300 feet above you. And there was a hole in the ceiling, and a shaft of light came through it in the far distance, and it was shining on a huge, well, it looked like a dune, like a golden dune. And as you got closer, it was shimmering, so there was a kind of rippling, shimmering light over it. Couldn't think what it was. And what it was a huge dune of bat droppings, and the golden shimmer came because it was covered by a carpet of cockroaches, which were slowly chewing their way through the bat droppings. And in among the carpet of cockroaches, there were little black beetles which were eating the dead bodies of the cockroaches, and all around the sides there were spiders which had made their webs to catch such baby cockroaches as strayed off the dune. And right at the bottom of all this there was a pallid white python which was eating the dead bodies of the million and a quarter bats that were living above it. Well, I suppose that was on the unexpected side.
It sounds like an absolutely terrifying illustration of the ecological chain.
Oh, you're quite right. I mean, what was nice about that and fascinating about that was that it was such a perfect ecological community. The only thing that actually came into the cave was bought by those bats that flew out in the middle of the night to collect insects. And actually there were some cave swiftlets which went out also during to collect food. But those two were the only input, and the rest was just recycling what was there. So it was, from a biological point of view, it was fascinating. I have to tell you, as a matter of fact, it was fascinating anyway. I mean, we in the end climbed up that dune. Smelt a bit, I have to say, it smelt a bit of ammonia. And by the time I got to the top, this million and a quarter bats had decided that it was rather alarming, and they were taking off, and they were circling around in a great maelstrom in the ceiling so that you could actually feel the wind created by their wings. And so they were flying quite close, and they were coming in between me and the camera. And so I thought, in order to comfort viewers, I might say, now there are a lot of people who think that bats are sort of kind of dangerous and that they fly and get caught in your hair and it's all a disaster. And of course, they have this very, very subtle and sensitive sonar system that makes it quite impossible for them to actually climb a cannon into people. So there's no need to worry. And the cameraman said, great, cut. And as he said, cut, a huge bat came and hit me straight in the middle of the face. So people never knew the answer to that.
Maybe the bat didn't hear about their sensitive
That's
sonar.
That's right. Like so often, occasionally you find these animals that haven't read the book and they don't know what to do.
So you used footage from that in your program?
No, I did, yes, but that was some time ago. That isn't in the Mediterranean. The little fruit bats which we were talking about in Cyprus are really generally quite innocuous little things, actually. The reason that they are very interesting is that they are the most northerly living of all the fruit bats, which are quite different from the insectivorous bats, and which don't normally have sonar. But these particular fruit bats live in farther south in the caves of the pharaohs, and they have actually acquired a sort of a very curious way of squeaking out of the corners of their mouth, so that they can find their way in the dark. And as a consequence of that, they can live in caves and so escape the winters of the Mediterranean.
David Attenborough is my guest, and he produced and hosted The Living Planet, Life on Earth, and he has a new series that starts on many PBS stations next week. It's called The First Eden, and he also has a companion book of the same name. In the new series, there's one shot where you've crawled into this rock ledge, I guess, a little rock shelf, where a baby seal has taken refuge. And it's a very narrow opening there, so you've kind of like crawled in, stretched alongside the seal, and you're describing why the seal would have to take refuge in a place like this, and that the seal's really too young to swim. And it really made me think, what does it feel like to be in such in this spot that's made for seals and not for people, and to be narrating into a microphone?
Yeah.
And this has happened to you around the world, actually. You've been on tops of mountains and in swamps and caves and deserts. describing into a microphone what's happening around you and why. And you've been doing this in places that humans seldom go. It must feel, and people do stand-ups in front of the White House all the time, but it must feel funny doing that in front of animals.
Yes, I suppose it does. Actually, I think you've got to be very careful how often you do it, because by and large, what people are looking at the programme for is not to see you and saying how clever and intrepid he is, but they're actually turning on to see the animals. And there has to be some reason as to why it is that you are sticking your face between the camera and the animal. And often you can, if there's not a good reason, then you are an intrusion and you shouldn't be doing it. The reasons that you might wish to do it are partly because you wish to direct people's attention to a certain aspect of the animal, partly to show how it behaves to human beings, partly to show whether it's tame or not. Those are the sort of reasons that are, it seems to me, make it justify. But I think by and large you ought to be careful how much you stick your face in front of the camera.
You started doing nature programs for the BBC in, I think it was 1954. What was the state of the art then for programs about animals and nature?
Well, the BBC, you see, was BBC television was set up Prime Minister's television. And,
you mean live television?
Oh, absolutely, because there was no recording of any kind then. I mean, even recording on film, what they used to call kinescopes, was a very primitive and very foggy business. I mean, you could hardly see anything through a thick London pea super fog. It looked like people, characters moving dimly about, so you didn't use them very much. No, nearly all our television was live, and we were an offshoot of BBC Radio. And if we wanted to use any film, we would say we'd like to use film, and our bosses in radio would say, film? What do you want to use film for? We've given you a camera. We've even, on some occasions, given you two cameras. I mean, electronic cameras. Why do you want to use film? We've got a studio. So that they were not at all sympathetic towards the idea that I should push off to Africa with a film camera. So what we did in those days was to use to bring live animals into the studio, which, of course, were extremely popular because they always wet down your front or escaped or bit you or something. And people thought that was terrific. The best thing was that we, in those days, and back in 1952, all of the television in the United Kingdom came from two small studios, each one about the size of a tennis court, not much bigger. And, of course, since those were the only two television studios in Europe at that time, you had to get a lot of shows out of them. And if you actually had a show, say, at 5:30 in the afternoon or 6 o'clock for the kiddies, and you had a little animal in there which escaped, people would know that the animal would be around in that particular studio later on in the evening. So that I remember one particular occasion we had a little flying squirrel, and the man who was presenting the show said, "Look at this charming little squirrel." And he leant forward, and in order to get the noise being made by the squirrel, the man with the microphone boom pushed it forward, and the little squirrel went hop, and it jumped onto the microphone boom and was off, you see. And of course the man who was presenting the programme said, charming little thing, well, I'm sure we shall catch him later on. But everybody knew that he wouldn't, so they turned on throughout the evening to see. And of course he turned up in the end in the middle of a Shakespearean production. There was a little flying squirrel on one of the columns at the back, and he was around. He appeared in our programme for about a following week before we caught him.
So was that a good enough reason to get you out of the studio and into the wilds of Africa?
The reason I, of course, did that was I wanted to go to Africa. It wasn't because I thought I was going to make terrific programs, though I hope there were reasonable programs.
But of course, you had to give them a good reason why they
would benefit. Yeah, I explained that, of course, in order to show, we mustn't show animals as freaks, I said. You mustn't show them just out of their environment when they do look strange, you know. In order to make sense of an animal and to treat an animal with proper dignity, you should actually show it in its proper surroundings. So eventually they gave us £50 and said, go away to Africa and bring us back a bit of film and be a good boy and don't cause us more trouble. So off I went for 4 months.
You know, the animal program genre has developed in several ways. You do very humanistic, educational, reflective programs about animals and their interaction with nature and with humans. But there's other aspects of the genre I'd like to ask your opinion about. One is the kind of Wild Kingdom type program. The way I remember this genre, there's a couple of guys dressed as kind of great white hunters who go out and track down the wild wildebeest and maybe hunt it. They're very macho programs. What do you think of that genre?
Well, I think actually they're... That kind of show, I think, is now outdated, to be truthful.
I still see them showing up, to tell you the
well,
truth.
Well, maybe. And of course, a lot of things that are outdated that still go on.
True.
But I think that the taste of people these days, of viewers these days, particularly young people, is not the kind of mankind-dominating nature, look how tough I am, and particularly not, there's an elephant, why don't we shoot it? There's another one, let's throw a net over it and strangle it. No, I think people these days are very much more sensitive to the rights of animals and the dignity of animals and the respect that animals deserve. And they appreciate much more, thank goodness, the kind of programme which attempts to show the animal as it truly is, living in its own environment and in as undisturbed a way as possible.
There's another kind of show now that's very popular in America, and that is the... perhaps I'm being unfair here, but a lot of the shows about animals seem to really show off how cute the animals are, as if there were teddy bears romping around together in the wild.
Yeah, I mean, the kind of Up Pop Mother Frog kind of program, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, I don't think people need that either these days. I actually think that in the last... well, in my lifetime, in my broadcasting lifetime, which is 35 years odd, the whole attitude of the public to animals has changed. And people now actually have a great sensitivity and interest in finding out how animals exist and how they live. And you don't have to say, isn't it cute because it's like a little baby? Or you don't have to anthropomorphize and say, you know, you can see that he's having his little joke or that sort of thing. People are now much more... perceptive about the true nature of animals, and they want to see what really happens.
Well, I want to talk with you some more about your experiences creating television programs about humans and people and nature. But first, we're going to take a short break. My guest is David Attenborough, who produced and hosted the series Life on Earth and the Living Planet. A new series is going to begin on many PBS stations this Monday, and the series is called The First Eden. And it's about the Mediterranean. There's also a companion book of the same name. We'll talk some more after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
David Attenborough is my guest. Well, a couple of minutes ago, you were telling us about that very first trip that you made to Africa to do a film for the BBC. You must have had comparatively primitive equipment to go off with, film equipment.
Oh, in those days, I mean, in the 50s, they were primitive to a degree. I mean, the camera worked by clockwork. You wound it up. And it could only take 100-foot reels. That's only 2:40 before you had to change the film, and it only took a run of about 30 seconds or something of that sort. And there was no way in which you could actually link that to a recorder so that it synchronized the film and sound tape together. So the result was really very primitive indeed. And our lenses were comparatively short focal length, so you were jolly lucky if you could actually see the animal in the far distance. I mean, you certainly couldn't get the sort of close-up of its right nostril, which is what you can do today. And the whole thing has been transformed. But that was part of the excitement, really, because every year you got a new bit of equipment. Every year you thought, gosh, that meant we could do this or we could do that or we could go and get this new view of that. And so that means, actually, that since we've now reached almost the limit of optical refinements, it means now that the thing is getting very tough because, you know, in Life on Earth we showed a mole running down its tunnel, and everybody said, that's fantastic. Gosh, did you see that show we saw? We went actually followed a mole and it went down into its tunnel and we saw it running along and catching worms. Isn't it amazing how they did that, see? And then, of course, next year, someone else does it, and they say, isn't it boring? It's nothing but moles, you know, going down tunnels. Oh, God, I wish they'd find something new. So it's quite tough making these shows.
You always feel like you have to top your last performance.
You expect that, or I don't know about me expecting, but certainly the audience expects that you get something, that you try and do new things every now and again.
What I can't figure out is, when you go into the field, you frequently know what you're looking for and what type of rare animal you're going in search of. How do you know where to look and when to look?
Well, you are quite right, and that I perhaps should have mentioned as one of the revolutionary changes in natural history filmmaking between over the last 30 years. 30 years ago, if you went out into the forest, there wasn't anybody there. There was just you and perhaps some of the local people. But though you hardly ever met another European who was studying the animals. But in this last 30 years, there has been a huge change in the science of zoology. And whereas 30 years ago, if you were a scientist, by and large, your work was in a laboratory looking at dead animals or with any luck, a sort of white rat running around a maze. These days, behavioural scientists and zoologists and naturalists are out in the field actually watching what the animals do. So wherever you go, there is likely to be somebody who knows something about that animal and has watched it in the field. And you may think that if someone came up to a scientist who spent 20 years of his life in appalling conditions watching the behaviour of a monkey troop, and I turn up and say, well, we'd just like to get the aggressive display, which has been very seldom seen and never filmed, of this particular troop, and we know you can do it, will you show us? You might think those people would say, you're crazy. I mean, I've spent 20 years trying to do that. You think I'm just going to give you the cream? Get lost. Well, I would understand it if they said that, but I can say with my hand on my heart that they have never once ever said anything like that at all. What they have said, you go to these far-flung parts of remotest Africa and they say, hi, come in, so you're interested in my animals that I'm so crazy for. We're delighted to see you. Let me show you this. I'm so proud of them. I think they're so interested and I'm delighted to show you. And so we are able to get insights into animal behaviour and animals that you could never, never get working entirely by yourself.
That's interesting. You know, a lot of our listeners have seen you in what appears to be pretty risky circumstances, for a shot of an animal or for a certain aspect of nature. Did you ever have to decide how far you were willing to go in order to get a good shot?
How big a risk you were willing to go?
Was there a shot that you decided was too far?
No. Well, no, I'm not one of these brave chaps. I am a dyed-in-the-wool coward. If I think that rhinoceros is going to charge, I get up the tree before it charges. All my friends are not like that. I have a number of friends who make natural history films who simply love being charged by rhinoceroses and will actually deliberately sort of go a bit closer. But my view is that if I get back from having made one of these films for the BBC and said, with a little sack full of jingling cogwheels and broken glass, and say, well, here it is, that's the camera, you see, I was charged by a rhinoceros, I was really very, very intrepid, and it beat the camera to pulp into the ground. They don't say, well done, you brave reporter. They say, what do you mean, looking after BBC equipment in that kind of way? You should be more careful, and they're quite right. So I make it my policy not to be charged and not to get in danger. Mine, of course, every now and again you do something silly, but that's nearly your fault, and it's by mistake, as far as I'm concerned.
So no close calls?
Not really. No. I mean, every now and again, I mean, when you sometimes you do silly things. I mean, I remember very foolishly when I was much younger, thinking a snake was a non-poisonous snake and handling it with some degree of aplomb, and I had it in my hand, and when I suddenly realised that it wasn't one of those harmless things, but it was one bite, certain death. And I was holding it by the throat at the time. The difficulty was to know how to stop holding it by the throat without getting bitten. But it was all right in the end.
Your brother is the director, Richard Attenborough, who did the films A Chorus Line and Gandhi, among others. Once you started getting on camera and involved with television, was there any sense of competitiveness between you?
Oh, no, not at all. No. His line of country and his expertise and his skills are Absolutely different from mine, such as mine are. I mean, the whole technique is quite different. You see, he by and large, actors, the more you get them to repeat what they're going to do, the better they get. I can assure you, with gorillas, it's different. I mean, they do it once and that's it. And if you haven't got it that time, they don't want to know, so they don't repeat. And not only that, but I work with a crew. I mean, when we go out, there's only five of us. When my brother goes out, there's 500.
Uh-huh. You were the BBC program director for a while. Mm. This is what, in the late 60s, early 70s?
70s.
And then you stepped down from that, and you went back into television and started not only producing but hosting. I think I know several people who are in management who'd love to probably be back in production, but it's considered a step down once you're in management. Was it a difficult move for you to make to get out of one of the top management positions of the BBC and decide you want to make programs again?
No, not at all difficult, really, to be truthful. I mean, I had a marvelous job for the first 4 years because I was starting a new network, and I had tens of millions of pounds to play with to commission new programs and new ideas and develop new schedules. And so I had really a marvelous time. But then things changed. I mean, I then took editorial responsibility for both of BBC's networks, and then it became much more to do with finance and trade unions and politicians and computers, and what I enjoy doing is making programs. So I didn't, by the time I'd done 8 years of administration, you know, I'd played the piano and educated the kids and got the house, so what the hell, you know, why didn't you go back and do what you enjoy doing, which is what I did.
Your new series is on the Mediterranean. What kind of shape is the Mediterranean in now, ecologically, the sea itself?
Well, it is marginally better than it was. You can say that, but 10 years ago it was dying, and there wasn't much doubt about that. Everybody, and quite a lot of people, thought that it would die totally. That the amount of effluent, of sewage, of chemical pollution, of oil spills, of overfishing, the general enormous concentration of people without any care whatsoever for the environment that were clustered around its shores, would seal its fate. And right at the last moment, well, the countries around could see this happening. And, of course, economically, the sea is very important to them, if only for tourism. And here you had a situation where the most expensive and fashionable beaches on the whole of the Mediterranean, indeed probably all the world, in the south of France, you were expecting people to come down to these places and bathe amongst raw sewage and dead fish. And something had to be done. And it wasn't any good just France doing anything about its beaches, because unless somebody further along the seaboard did something about them, or somebody on the other side of the sea in North Africa did something about them, then it would be just as bad. So, in fact, you had to have an international conference. And the amazing thing was, you see, that the countries around the Mediterranean are just about as varied as any countries you can find. I mean, there are Christians and there are Muslims and there are black and there are white and rich and poor and communist and capitalist. And you would think all those people who are at this very moment still fighting at the eastern end of the sea would never, never sit down together. Well, they did, and are still doing so. And they actually agreed on how to measure pollution and how to control pollution.
So this international cooperation has left you optimistic?
Well, the answer is marginally and hopefully, yes.
David Attenborough, thank you very much for talking with us about your work. My guest has been David Attenborough. He produced the TV series The Living Planet and Life on Earth. His new series, The First Eden, traces the natural history of the Mediterranean and man's changing attitudes toward the natural world. The series begins Monday on many PBS stations. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Todd Gitlin. His books and articles have analyzed media coverage of contemporary culture. His new book is about the political and countercultural movements of the 60s. I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, we remember bandleader Woody Herman, who died Thursday at the age of 74. He discussed his life in jazz in an interview we recorded in 1986. Also, Brazilian guitarist Orlando Haddad joins us again for our weekly performance spot to play a song he wrote inspired by his father's poetry. And critic-at-large Laurie Stone discusses comic Mort Saul's comeback. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Mark Boardman in Washington. President Reagan will welcome Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev to the U.S. on December 7th. The president made the summit announcement today, saying the occasion will be used to sign an agreement banning all medium-range missiles. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The announcement came after an hour-long meeting between the president and Soviet Foreign Minister Eduard Shevardnadze, who carried a letter from Gorbachev in which the Soviet leader accepted the president's invitation to the U.S. Mr. Reagan said the full range of U.S. and Soviet relations will be discussed next month, including a possible 50% cut in the two sides' long-range strategic missiles. The president said progress on that issue is not linked to U.S. concessions on the Strategic Defense Initiative.
I've made it clear, and there's no, they've not rejected this, that there's no way that we can give up SDI, which we believe is offering an opportunity for peace for the world.
Just 1 week ago, prospects for a summit meeting this year looked gloomy, but a change of heart by Gorbachev has changed things to the point where the two sides are not only planning for December, but for a possible presidential trip to Moscow next year. I'm Brian Naylor at the White House.
Today, for the second day in a row, stock prices closed sharply higher. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was up more than 55 points to finish at 1993.53. Like yesterday, today's rally was broad-based, with advances leading declines by 7-1 on volume of 305 million shares. Prices were also higher on the over-the-counter market and the American Stock Exchange. The New York Exchange will extend its shortened trading sessions through next week. The market will close 90 minutes early on Monday and Tuesday, and an hour early the rest of the week. The dollar continued its decline against the mark and the yen. Investors are not convinced that central banks are prepared to slow the currency's fall. The government's main measure of economic activity fell last month for the first time since January. The index of leading economic indicators dropped 0.1%. Declines in the average work week and lower stock prices were the big factors in that decline. Economist Deborah Johnson says gains in some of the other indicators point to a healthy economy.
Looking at the indicators in general, it was pretty much a mixed bag, but the industrial sector or the economy in general looks like it was fairly strong in the third quarter.
Commerce Department economist Robert Ortner says if stock prices close the month with a 20% decline, the October index would be depressed by 2%. The jury in a landmark trial in Fort Lauderdale has found the mother of a 17-year-old girl who killed herself guilty of mental child abuse. It's the first time such a charge has been pursued in a case where the abuse ended in suicide. NPR's Joe Maglino reports.
It took the five women and one man on the jury 3 days to find 41-year-old Teresa Jackson guilty on all charges against her. Jackson had been charged with aggravated child abuse for pushing her 17-year-old daughter, Tina Mancini, to suicide last year by forcing her to work as a stripper. Jackson was also found guilty today of procuring the sexual performance of a child and of altering Tina's birth certificate to make her appear older. Jackson and her family showed no emotion when the verdict was read. She faces up to 25 years in jail for the crimes. Judge Arthur Franza, who had received a death threat during jury deliberations, ordered Jackson held for psychiatric treatment. Sentencing is set for December 3rd. This is Joe Maglino reporting.
Big band leader Woody Herman is dead. Herman, who led his thundering herd in six different decades, died in Los Angeles yesterday of cardiac arrest. He'd been ill for some time. Herman's band was a training ground for numerous jazz musicians. Woody Herman was 74 years old. I'm Mark Boardman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Singer, guitarist, and composer Orlando Haddad joins us again today for our weekly performance spot. Orlando was born and raised in Brazil, but he's lived in this country since 1974. On a visit home, he was inspired to write the song that he's going to play for us now. The lyrics are in his native Portuguese.
This song is about a sunset. I wrote this song in Brazil several years ago in my homeland of Minas Gerais. And I used two poems by my father. My father was a physician in Minas Gerais, and he was a very sensitive man. He was, besides being a very humanitarian type of doctor who cared for the poor, he was also a poet. And after his death, reading his poetry, I got inspired, and I liked what he said, and I wrote the song actually watching a sunset.
Policromias irisadas fascinantes na crepuscular magia colorida e o sol poente é um lindo sonho que no horizonte belo aconteceu nessa nostalgia. Presente nesta hora este sentimento que não sabemos o que é, mas que não obstante existe. Saudade desconcertante enlevo envolvente, estranho devaneio, ilusão fascinante, algo que nos empolga em alguma coisa distante no céu infinito, a presença do que se achava perto longe ficou numa saudade, na ausência imensa. Saudade.
Olha o sol se pondo em rubro e majestade, terno em câmara lenta,
no acidente. Encanto na paisagem, solitário, espaço aberto de tons, tons cambiantes. E eu, poeira no tempo, questiono a origem de tudo, querendo penetrar seus mistérios. Mas olha o sol tombando em rubro e majestade, terno em câmara lenta no acidente. Mas olha o sol se pondo em rubro e majestade, terno em câmara lenta no acidente. Mas olha o sol se pondo, sol poente.
I'm Orlando Haddad, and that was one of my compositions called Poente, which means sunset.
Orlando Haddad and his band Minos are at work on a second album. Their first was called Numja Azu, In a Blue Day.
Listening to Fresh Air.
We'd like to take this time to remember the great bandleader Woody Herman. He died Thursday in Los Angeles from congestive heart failure. He was 74. Herman was an accomplished clarinet and saxophone player, but his greatest achievement was as a bandleader, directing innovative soloists and arrangers. Herman's band first became known nearly 50 years ago for their recording of Woodchopper's Ball. Stayed on the road with his big band until failing health made travel impossible. He was also plagued by financial problems. He owed the IRS a hefty sum of money, resulting from a business manager's shady dealings back in the 60s. Recently, jazz fans and friends rallied to his support with fundraising concerts. I spoke to Woody Herman in May of 1986 while he was still on the road with his band. He told me that he started his long performing career as a child in vaudeville.
I was a song and dance kid. And then with the money I made from the first or second road tour, I've forgotten, I got my first saxophone and then later a clarinet and started to study with local teachers in Milwaukee.
Had you heard jazz then?
No, I didn't hear jazz really or become aware of it until I got into the teenage stage of life. But when I announced to my mother and father that I was no longer in showbiz and that I was leaving it forever and I was about to embark on a jazz musician's career, I think they both went into a dead faint because as long as I was in the theater, that seemed safe to them. But being a jazz musician, just like the word jazz, was thought of as a very bad, dirty kind of thing.
This is amazing. First of all, so many parents wouldn't want their kids in showbiz because they think that was unsafe.
Yes.
And then your parents didn't want you in jazz. So
I think everybody has a different concept of what success is.
How did you start that first band? You had been playing with the Isham Jones Band.
Isham Jones Band. I was with them. And when he retired, there were six of us all together, five others and me, and we decided to band together, stick together, and become a cooperative group, and I was voted to stand in front of the band.
How come you were the one who was chosen to front the band?
Because of my showbiz career background. Yeah, I'm sure of that because I wasn't a slick player at that point, but I was adequate, and I knew how to talk to an audience and how to handle people. And that's why the guys voted me in.
I think you've been very self-effacing in a way as a soloist. Would you have liked to be better known as a soloist?
No. I never had any great desire about that. I wanted to be okay and not get in anybody's way, and maybe I could even add something on occasion. That's what I did.
You've said that you've never thought of yourself as a great clarinetist. How do you feel about the instrument?
I don't like the instrument. I don't think I ever did. I think it's a very difficult, too difficult instrument to express yourself properly.
If you dislike the clarinet so much, how come you played it? Because you also were a saxophonist.
Well, it was the American boy's instrument in the 30s and 40s. You know, if you didn't have a clarinet and stood in front of the band, well, what are you there for? It was almost at that point.
There's a lot of musicians that really got started in your band, and just to tick off a few, Stan Getz, Al Cohn, Zoot Sims, Jimmy Giuffre.
Right. The Four Brothers, so were some of the people that later came on the scene.
What do you look for? How do you audition someone? Let's start with the 30s and 40s. How did you then go about finding people?
Then it was really less difficult if there was somebody that you really liked, and if they were working for someone else, you try to get them to join your band because you were trying to play new things and probably more musical things. And those that wanted to progress joined us, and I think that was a big come on as far as guys were concerned.
The band that you led in the 30s and the early 40s, mm-hmm. you described as a cooperative band that was an
right.
offshoot of the Isham Jones Band. What was the first band that you really thought of as being yours?
Well, let me tell you why that band was changed, and there was a different kind of evolution took place, but it was because of wartime. And as people were drafted out and went into the service, we had to get different kind of people or new people or people who we thought would work for us. And then I decided that it was now my sole responsibility and I wanted to do more progressive music than we were doing in the earliest days. And I wanted to improve. I wanted the band to improve and be one that could play all kinds of music and do it well.
Another thing that made that band unique was that it was a big band that was playing harmonies and rhythms that came out of bop. And I think a lot of the big bands really were resisting
that. They weren't
that.
Interested, and I was. So, as a matter of fact, our whole band, shortly before we went into the second herd, if you want to call it that, the Four Brothers herd, I insisted that our whole band, that we would go to hear Charlie Parker at his opening on 52nd Street with Dizzy and a few of our friends, because Dizzy was already writing for our band.
Was it hard to figure out how to incorporate the rhythmic and harmonic innovations of bop into a big band setting?
Well, I think you had to have imagination, and I think that you... in other words, there's two kinds of music, as Ellington said many times, and certainly Stravinsky said it to me personally. Two kinds of music, good and bad, and we were definitely trying to play good.
Second Herd, which was your second band, you organized that in 46 or 47.
47.
And this was just about the time that a lot of the big bands were starting to
fold. That's when they all disappeared, yeah.
Yeah, so you were really going against the tide then by organizing
ways.
A big band. Yeah.
Well, everybody left except Ellington, Basie, and maybe Harry James. And everyone else just took a run for it, and mostly. And...
Was it hard to keep the bands going? Is that why so many of them disappeared?
Yeah, well, financially it was a bust. It was no longer a business. It was now a hobby, and if you could afford it, you did it.
How were you able to do it?
Because I made it a hobby. And I've suffered the consequences ever since, you know. I got into trouble later with the IRS, and I'm still in trouble with them at this late date.
You once said that what would have made the best financial sense would have been after 1946 or so to take your money and invest it, not invest it in a band,
well, of course.
Invest it.
Yeah, oh, of course, yeah.
But obviously you've put music first.
Well, it's been above everything in my lifetime, so sometimes it's been a disservice to me as a person, but that's beside the point because I still have that love and affection for music. And our Lord has been kind to me. Let's look at it that way.
Woody Herman's band performing Summer Sequence. Woody Herman died Thursday in Los Angeles. I spoke with him in May of 1986. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What's coming up?
Well, several reports tonight on the president's announcement of a December 7th summit with Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev, including what's on the table and also the political flap in the Soviet Union that set off last week's delay. Also a story on cowboy art.
What's that?
Well, Terry, that's genre painting, sort of Norman Rockwell-esque. Each painting must contain a man, preferably a cowboy, a horse, a glimpse of Western terrain, deserts or mountains, either will do, and have a hefty price tag. Also, tonight we'll take a look at minor league football players pay their own bus fare to games and play for the love of it.
Okay, thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Political and social satirist Mort Saul has taken his act to Broadway. It's a bid for a comeback by the comedian who, in his heyday, was considered an intellectual Lenny Bruce. Our critic at large, Laurie Stone, has these thoughts on Mort Saul in the 80s.
People I know who saw Mort Saul in the 50s, when he played the hungry eye in the village gate, say he had sharp teeth and honed politics. He went after McCarthy, saying the forbidden thing, whatever it needed to be. In the mid-60s, when I saw him live, he was already a crank. His upper lip was rising too quickly into a sneer, and he was grinning at his own cleverness before anyone else had a chance to. But he still gnashed at Nixon, Roy Cohn, and the Bay of Pigs goons. And in the late 60s and early 70s, when he cried cover-up about the Warren Report on John Kennedy's assassination, he warmed up our consciousnesses for the coming conspiracies of Watergate and the Iran-Contra game. In his Broadway concert, which runs for an intermissionless hour and 45 minutes, he tells us that, for the past 17 years, he's been living in L.A. and raking in the dough. He writes screenplays on contract that don't get produced. Ha ha! That laugh of his, how to describe it? A foghorn that wants you to hit the rocks. He says he has three topics: women, movies, and politics. He starts with women. Quote, I was watching Geraldo, and four women came on who didn't want to get married. Ha ha! By the looks of them, they were in no danger of that happening. Unquote. This, listeners, is what comes from the mouth of a man who, even when he was young, had a jaw and chin that could politely be described as piranha, and who now, at 60, his midsection far wider than his shoulders, looks like a pear in a V-neck sweater. He does score a few hits when he targets Hollywood. David Beagleman, a dyed-in-the-wool liberal, complains that his children are conservative Republicans, and Saul asks him, quote, do you think all the recreational drugs you did in the 60s created mutants? Unquote. However, most of Saul's jokes only pinpoint when he lost touch with the times. He knows that the Pentagon and the CIA make foreign policy, but he's not unhappy about it. He admits to voting for Nixon. He brags about forming a friendship with Alexander Haig. He spends the last half hour of his show explaining how, maverick that he is, he resisted the pressure of the Hollywood liberal establishment and went to a dinner at the White House. Famous names drop from his mouth like gold coins. Newman, Fonda, Redford, Redgrave. You can hear them tinkling under his feet, then more names cascade forth. Malcolm Forbes, Weinberger, Schultz, Bush, and Nancy, dear, party-loving, 15-pound Nancy. Saul can't believe these eminences are talking to him, but more important, are eating with him, kibitzing with him, sharing with him. Yitzhak Shamir, the honored guest, implores him to tell his audience not to arm the Saudis. Saul gets Reagan off the dance floor to break up a mushrooming tiff between Weinberger and Shamir. Ooh, what fun to mingle in the bullpen. Saul doesn't go to the White House to make trouble, but to hang out. And you know how it is when you eat someone's food and drink their wine and then dance to their Marine Corps band. You can't turn around and bite them without looking like a schnurrer. Mort is not a schnurrer. He's another awkward and directionless guy whose head has been turned by commanding jawlines. He can't bite anything now but his own tail. The worst has happened to someone in his line who's abandoned the work but still wants to collect the check. He's become irrelevant.
Laurie Stone is a New York-based writer and critic and is a contributor to The Village Voice. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, we'll hear our postponed interview with syndicated political cartoonist Dan Wasserman. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead will review the new album by flugelhornist Art Farmer, and television critic David Bianculli will preview Beverly Hills Bunce, a spin-off series from Hill Street Blues featuring Dennis Franz as Norman Bunce. So I hope you can join us. We want to welcome a station new to Fresh Air, WVTF in Roanoke, Virginia. We'd like to hear from you. Write to us with your comments and suggestions. The address is Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. That's Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Chris Burton directs the show. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.